The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second week reading from the December 23rd/December 30th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine. This issue is their year-end review issue titled The Faces of 2016. And as I mentioned last week, we read some more of the current issues then. And this week, we'll take some of the more year-end review type articles. And the first one we'll start with, which goes month by month through the year, is titled The Year in Review. January. President Barack Obama begins his final year in office as the nation prepares to choose a new leader. Hillary Clinton, once prohibitive favorite for the Democratic nomination, heads into the primary season clinging to a narrow poll lead over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The crotchety, wild-haired Sanders, 74, running as an economic populist, finds a passionate following among younger Democrats who flock to his rallies by tens of thousands. On the Republican side, New York real estate billionaire Donald Trump still enjoys an improbable double-digit lead in the polls over a crowded GOP field. Trump's nearest rivals are Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Florida Senator Marco Rubio, while former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, once the party's presumptive nominee, has seen his poll numbers slide into the single digits, thanks in part to a sustained campaign of mockery by Trump, much of it on Twitter, who insist Bush is too low energy to be president. February. As the Iowa caucuses, the first vote in the presidential selection process, Clinton squeaks past Sanders by a razor-thin margin, while on the GOP side, Cruz beats Trump by 4%. Most encouraging to Republican Party leaders, who see both Trump and Cruz as too extreme to win a general election, is a strong third-place finish by Rubio. At a Republican debate on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, however, a flustered Rubio repeats the same canned, ungrammatical talking point, "Let's dispel with this fiction that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing," no fewer than four times. Rival Chris Christie mocks Rubio on stage as robotic, and Rubio slides to a dismal fifth-place finish in New Hampshire, as Trump wins the state by a resounding 20 points. Desperate to save his candidacy, Rubio, whom Trump has taken to calling Lil Marco, fights back with comments about Trump's own physical appearance. "You know what they say about men with small hands," Rubio says. Supreme Court Justice and conservative icon Antonin Scalia dies in his sleep at the age of 79. Conspiracy theorists suggest that Democrats murdered him by putting a pillow over his face. March. At the next Republican debate, Trump shows the crowd what he insists is a pair of normal-sized hands and, in a first for American political discourse, assures voters that there's no problem with the size of his penis either. Trump and Clinton go on to dominate the Super Tuesday primaries, though Sanders pulls off a big upset in the Rust Belt state of Michigan. After losing to Trump in his home state of Florida, Rubio drops out of the race. In Europe, ISIS spreads fear across the continent when suicide bombers terrorize Brussels, killing 31 in coordinated attacks on the city's subway system and airport. President Obama makes a historic visit to Cuba, and calls for an end to the 54-year U.S. trade embargo against the island. In Washington, Obama picks Judge Merrick Garland, 63, to fill the empty seat on the Supreme Court. But GOP Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refuses to hold confirmation hearings, insisting that Scalia's replacement should be chosen by the next president. In Syria, government and Russian warplanes violate a ceasefire and bomb rebel strongholds in Aleppo, now the site of a full-blown humanitarian crisis. April. Cruz wins the Republican primaries in Wisconsin and Colorado, raising the prospect of a brokered party convention at which delegates could choose a nominee other than Trump. Trump warns of riots if the party denies him the nomination. Sanders, meanwhile, is enjoying a hot streak, winning 7 out of 8 consecutive primaries, but Clinton's resounding win in delegate-rich New York keeps her on track for the nomination. May. Donald Trump scores a crushing victory in the Indiana primary, prompting his two remaining rivals, Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich, to exit the race. Trump is now the GOP's de facto nominee, though some mainstream Republicans are still hesitant to endorse him. "I'm not there right now," said House Speaker Paul Ryan. On the Democratic side, Clinton's steady march toward the nomination continues, though she still faces questions about her use of a private email server during her time as Secretary of State, which is the subject of an ongoing investigation by the FBI. June. With a string of primary wins, Clinton finally clinches the Democratic nomination. She will be the first woman in U.S. history to lead a major political party into a presidential election. Republicans show signs of starting to unite behind Trump, though Trump sparks fresh controversy when he says that an Indiana-born judge presiding over a fraud suit against him has an absolute conflict of interest because he's a Mexican. An exasperated Ryan calls that a textbook racist comment. British voters shocked the world when, in a special referendum, they vote narrowly to leave the European Union. The so-called Brexit vote roils global financial markets and prompts British Prime Minister David Cameron to announce his resignation. In Orlando, a gunman enters Pulse, a gay nightclub, and shoots dead 50 clubgoers, dialing 911 during his rampage and pledging allegiance to ISIS. July. In Nice, France, a Tunisian-born Muslim immigrant plows a 19-ton truck into crowds celebrating Bastille Day. The horrific attack kills 86 people, including at least 10 children, before the driver dies in a gun battle with authorities. The French government responds with new airstrikes against ISIS targets in Syria, though a clear terrorist motive for the attack is never established. In the U.S., the police shootings of two black men, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, sparked national protest by the Black Lives Matter movement. At one protest in Dallas, a sniper shoots and kills 5 police officers before being killed himself by a police robot armed with a bomb. In an unusual press conference, FBI Director James Comey announces the Bureau will not recommend any charges against Clinton for her use of a private email server for official State Department business, but says her handling of classified information was extremely careless. A rowdy Republican National Convention opens in Cleveland. Egged on by delirious cries of "lock her up" from the crowd, now a constant refrain at Trump's boisterous campaign rallies, speaker after speaker tears into Hillary Clinton as a criminal. Trump's wife, Melania, gives a speech that turns out to be partly plagiarized from a 2008 speech by First Lady Michelle Obama. On the convention's final night, Trump paints a dark portrait of an America ridden with crime, poverty, and illegal immigration and proclaims, "I alone can fix it." At the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, a long list of party luminaries deliver rousing testimonial to Clinton's fitness to lead. But the most memorable speech is delivered by Khizr Khan, 66, the father of a Muslim soldier killed in Iraq, who brandishes a copy of the Constitution and condemns Trump for his anti-Muslim rhetoric. Clinton lays out a detailed policy agenda in her acceptance speech. She also warns voters that a man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons. August. Trump launches his general election campaign by feuding with Khizr Khan, and at one riotous rally in North Carolina, jokes that if Clinton is elected, only Second Amendment people will be able to stop her. Clinton suffers a setback with new allegations that foreign and corporate donors to the charitable Clinton Foundation received preferential treatment from Clinton's State Department. But Trump's vitriolic attacks on critics eclipse Clinton's woes. And at month's end, he has slipped a full 6 points behind the Democrat in national poll averages. Trump starts warning his supporters that November's election is being rigged. In Aleppo, five-year-old Omran Dakhnish becomes a symbol of the carnage in Syria when a photo of the bloodied, dazed child goes viral. September. At a 9/11 memorial event in New York, Clinton is filmed collapsing and being propped up by aides as they hustle her into a waiting van. While the candidate recuperates from what her doctors say is about with pneumonia, a video surfaces of Clinton at a private fundraiser dismissing half of Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables, racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. By month's end, Trump has pulled level with Clinton in the polls. With anxiety over the election at fever pitch, the first presidential debate is the most watched in U.S. history. Clinton, relaxed, confident, and evidently healthy, emerges as the clear winner, while Trump comes across as sniffly, rambling, and unprepared, a performance he later blames on a defective microphone. October. Clinton regains her lead in the polls, but WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy group, starts publishing embarrassing internal emails from the Clinton campaign. Stolen, say U.S. intelligence services, by hackers working for Russia. The New York Times obtains documents showing that Trump declared a $916 million loss in the early 1990s and may have effectively paid no federal income tax for 18 years, which may explain his refusal to make public his tax returns. In a far more damaging revelation, 2005 video footage surfaces in which a 59-year-old Trump boasts to NBC's Billy Bush of kissing women without permission and being able to grab them by the blank with impunity because he's a star. Trump dismisses his remarks as locker room talk, but more than a dozen women come forward to say he forcibly kissed, grabbed, or groped them. At a second debate, Trump vows that if elected, he'll put Clinton in jail. With the election only 11 days away, FBI Director Comey announces the discovery of new emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation of Clinton's private email server, and her seemingly comfortable poll lead shrinks to just 2 or 3 percentage points. November. Comey announces that an FBI review of the new emails revealed nothing incriminating. Election day finally arrives, with most pollsters and pundits confidently predicting a Clinton victory. But as the votes are tallied that evening, the so-called blue wall of Democratic-leaning states in the Midwest crumbles. And in the small hours of November 9th, 2016, Donald J. Trump is declared the 45th President of the United States. It's perhaps the biggest upset in U.S. presidential election history. Although Clinton wins the popular vote by 2.8 million votes and 2 percentage points, not far off most predictions, Trump's success with white working class voters in the Rust Belt states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania give him a decisive edge in the Electoral College. As a stunned nation works through its shock, Trump has a cordial meeting with President Obama at the White House. In Cuba, Fidel Castro finally dies at the age of 90. December. All eyes remain on Trump Tower as the nation wonders what to expect from its unpredictable next president. Trump staffing picks, immigration hawk Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, and climate change skeptic Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, suggest a very conservative administration. But his intervention at Carrier's Indiana plant to save 800 jobs indicates he will use his power very unconventionally. In a breach of diplomatic protocol, Trump has a telephone conversation with the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen. When China files a complaint, Trump fires off several insulting tweets. The CIA tells Congress that Russia hacked into the Democratic emails in a deliberate attempt to hurt Clinton and help Trump, and the president-elect responds by questioning the agency's credibility. As a wild year draws to a close, all that seems certain is that the loudest voice for the foreseeable future will be that of Twitter user @RealDonaldTrump. The review of health and science topics for the year comes in a couple of pages where they break it down into some of the things they said were good for us, some of the things we were told to avoid, and the big scientific breakthroughs of 2016. So we'll take all three in, starting with some of the things they said were good for us. Exercise could help your brain stay young and lower your chances of cancer. In a study involving about 900 adults, those who did little or no regular physical activity experienced cognitive decline equivalent to 10 more years of aging compared with their more active peers. Early take-up was important. Exercise didn't appear to help people who were already showing signs of cognitive decline. Another study found that people who do the equivalent of about 2.5 hours of walking a week have a lower risk for 13 different forms of cancer. If people understand that physical activity can influence their risk for cancer, said lead author Stephen Moore, then that might provide yet one more motivating factor to become active. Carbs may not be so bad after all. While it is widely assumed that a high-carb diet leads to weight gain, researchers who looked into the eating habits of more than 23,000 Italians found that those who ate more pasta actually tended to have a lower body mass index. They speculated that pasta eaters were more likely to follow the Mediterranean diet, which is heavy on fruit, vegetables, and other healthy foods. Separate research concluded that carb-rich whole grains like oats and quinoa also have significant health benefits. Adults who ate 3 or more daily servings had a 20% lower risk of dying early. Multiple individual studies consistently revealed a reduced risk of early death among people who consumed more whole grains, said senior author Ki Sun. Sex may keep older people mentally sharp. In a British study of men and women ages 50 to 89, the sexually active participants scored higher in memory tests and got cognitive measures than those who got busy less often. Physical intimacy increases levels of dopamine and oxytocin in the brain. Researchers speculate that these feel-good hormones could improve neural connections, helping to ward off age-related mental decline. What we need to clarify now, says study leader Haley Wright, is whether engaging in sexual activity leads to better cognitive function, or whether people who have higher cognitive functioning are those who tend to remain sexually active. Dirt helps children stave off allergies. Kids are often scolded for biting their nails or sucking their thumbs, but researchers in New Zealand found that adults who grew up with these bad habits were much less likely to develop allergies to things like pets, grass, and dust mites. Their findings suggest that the immune system may benefit from early exposure to microbes. Being too clean isn't that good for you, said researcher Stephanie Lynch. Parents shouldn't be afraid to let their kids get dirty or let them have dirt under their nails. Books may make you live longer. Researchers at Yale University found that adults age 50 and over who read a book for at least 30 minutes a day lived for an average of almost 2 years longer than those who don't. Becoming engrossed in a love story, mystery, or thriller may trigger cognitive processes such as empathy, social perception, and emotional intelligence that can help promote longevity. Reading newspapers and magazines didn't have the same effect. The benefits of reading books, the study's authors conclude, include a longer life in which to read them. Cutting calories may improve your entire quality of life, not just your waistline. In a small study, a group of healthy, non-obese adults reduced their daily calorie intake by 12% for 2 years. Not only did they lose an average of 17 pounds, they also enjoyed improved sleep, better moods, and an enhanced sex drive. Once people get over the hump and start dropping pounds, said co-author Corby Martin, their hunger levels subside a bit, and they start to feel the benefits of the weight loss. Friends and family can be as important to your health as diet and exercise. A University of North Carolina study found that social isolation increases risk of high blood pressure more than diabetes, and that lonely people are 30% more likely to suffer a heart attack or stroke than those who are socially active. Friends can buffer some of the effects of stress and or help with coping, says lead author Kathleen Mullen-Harris. Separate research suggested that older people tend to live longer when they count a family member other than their spouse among their closest confidants. And some of the things we were told to avoid. Alcohol is even worse for us than we thought. A report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that booze is the second most deadly drug in the U.S., behind only tobacco. Between 2002 and 2014, alcohol-related deaths surged 37%. Drinking now accounts for more fatalities than overdoses from prescription painkillers and heroin combined. Other research found that alcohol is a direct cause of at least 7 forms of cancer, and that the more people drink, the worse their odds. 9 in 10 people aren't aware of this link between alcohol and cancer, said Jana Witt from Center Research UK. This review is a stark reminder that there's strong evidence linking the two. Opioids may do more harm than good. Powerful prescription drugs like OxyContin and Vicodin are widely used to treat severe and chronic pain. But a University of Colorado Boulder study found that injured rodents that had been given morphine were more sensitive to pain in the long run than those that hadn't. Researchers believe the drug may amplify pain signals from the spinal cord, prolonging and even intensifying discomfort. This is a very ugly side to opioids that had not been recognized before, said Linda Watkins, the study's co-leader. The implications for people taking opioids like morphine, oxycodone, and methadone are great. Distracted walking is a growing hazard as more and more people injure themselves while using their smartphone on the move. Pedestrian deaths jumped 10% in the first half of 2015, the largest year-on-year increase in four decades. Public health experts attribute that rise to distracted walkers, who now account for 10% of all pedestrian injuries requiring emergency room treatment. The phenomenon is most common among millennials, but women 55 and older suffer the most serious injuries. The human brain simply didn't evolve to multitask, explains orthopedic surgeon Claudette Lajam. You can't really pay attention to more than one thing at a time. Deep space could be too dangerous for manned exploration. A NASA-funded study found that astronauts who flew to the moon were four times more likely to die from heart disease than those who only traveled as far as low Earth orbit, where the International Space Station is located. Researchers believe this is due to their exposure to deep space radiation, which has also been linked to chronic cognitive impairment and dementia, or space brain. These obstacles will have to be overcome before astronauts can attempt a mission to Mars. We've probably underestimated the impact of deep space radiation, says Michael Delp, lead author of the NASA study. Marijuana may take a long-term toll on the mind. Researchers found that weed reduces blood flow to virtually every part of the brain. The effect is most notable in the hippocampus, the neural region responsible for learning and memory, which is particularly vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease. The media has given the general impression that marijuana is a safe recreational drug, says co-author Daniel Amen. This research directly challenges that notion. Separate studies this year found that long-time marijuana users are also more likely to have memory problems and are at a greater risk for gum disease. Insomnia may be caused by reduced integrity in nerve cells that connect different parts of the brain, a Chinese study found. Scans of insomniacs' brains showed that abnormalities in the so-called white matter were most significant in regions involved with sleep and alertness, as well as learning, memory, and emotion. It isn't yet clear whether these weaker neural connections are the cause of the insomnia or the result of chronic sleep deprivation. But radiologist Max Wintermark says the study takes us a step closer to a potential treatment. Trampolines are dangerous. As indoor trampoline parks have grown in popularity, the number of emergency room visits for injuries sustained at these play centers has shot up from 581 in 2010 to 6,932 in 2014. While many more people hurt themselves bouncing around in their backyards, trampoline park injuries tend to be more severe. The study's authors advise parents to supervise their kids and to be careful if they get on the canvas themselves. 19% of those hurt at trampoline parks are adults. And the big scientific breakthroughs of 2016, from gravitational waves to a helium reservoir, listening to the universe. A century after Albert Einstein first predicted the existence of gravitational waves, scientists this year finally identified one. When two enormous cosmic objects collide, the impact can distort space and time around them. Einstein posited that these distortions spread out in gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time that stretch and squeeze everything within them. Scientists recorded the sound of the wave, which came from two black holes colliding about 1.3 billion years ago. Using two extraordinarily sensitive laser detectors in Louisiana and Washington, the discovery confirms that astronomers will one day be able to listen to the universe rather than just seeing it. Finally, astronomy grew ears, says astrophysicist Saz Bloks-Marka. we never had ears before. Promising cancer treatment. The main problem with chemotherapy and other traditional forms of cancer treatment is that they destroy healthy cells as well as tumors. But a new type of immunotherapy known as adoptive T-cell therapy could be a potential game changer. The process involves extracting disease-fighting T-cells from patients, generically modifying them to enhance their cancer-fighting abilities, and reintroducing them back into the patient's body. In an early study, more than 90% of the terminally ill blood cancer patients given the treatment went into remission. While the results haven't yet been peer-reviewed, project leader Stanley Riddell describes them as unprecedented in medicine. A giant helium reservoir. Scientists this year discovered a massive reservoir of helium in East Africa, alleviating a critical global shortage of a precious resource used for MRI scanners, fiber optic cables, and particle accelerators. An odorless gas that forms over billions of years, helium is abundant in the universe but in limited supply on Earth. By using advanced seismic imaging and geochemistry techniques, scientists found more than a trillion liters of the elusive element in Tanzania. Almost more significant than the volume of helium found is that it was found on purpose, said John Gluyas, a member of the discovery team. Every other discovery of helium to date has been found by accident. Robotic arm with touch. Advances in mind-controlled prosthetics enabled a 30-year-old man who is paralyzed from the chest down to feel his fingers for the first time in a decade. A team of scientists remotely wired a sensory-enhanced, mind-controlled robotic arm to tiny electrodes in the patient's brain, effectively bypassing his damaged spinal cord. When the electrodes received signals from the prosthesis, the man was able to feel as well as move his fingers. The ultimate goal, said lead researcher Robert Gaunt, is to create a system which moves and feels just like a natural arm would. And finally, the ozone layer healing. The ozone layer is finally on the mend. It has been 3 decades since an international treaty banned the use of chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, the chemicals that were eating away at the atmosphere's protective shield. Researchers announced this year that a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica had shrunk by more than 4 million square kilometers and wasn't as deep as previously thought. Atmospheric chemist Michael Newchurch describes the healing of the ozone layer as the most significant environmental success story of our time. The last word article in this year-end issue is titled, Why We Need to Read. Amid our overscheduled, hectic lives, it's important that we find the time to pick up a book, said writer Will Schwalbe. Reading is the best way to both escape and engage with the world. We all ask each other a lot of questions, but we should all ask one question a lot more often. What are you reading? It's a simple question, but a powerful one, and it can change lives. Here's one example. I met at a bookstore a woman who told me that she had fallen sadly out of touch with her beloved grandson. She lived in Florida. He and his parents lived elsewhere. She would call him and ask him about school or about his day. He would respond in one-word answers. Fine. Nothing. Nope. And then one day she asked him what he was reading. He had just started The Hunger Games, a series of dystopian young adult novels by Suzanne Collins. The grandmother decided to read the first volume so that she could talk about it with her grandson the next time they chatted on the phone. She didn't know what to expect, but she found herself hooked from the first pages, in which Katniss Everdeen volunteers to take her younger sister's place in the annual battle to the death among a select group of teens. The book helped this grandmother cut through the superficialities of phone chat and engage her grandson on the most important questions that humans face about survival and destruction and loyalty and betrayal and good and evil, and about politics as well. Now her grandson couldn't wait to talk to her when she called, to tell her where he was, to find out where she was, and to speculate about what would happen next. Other than belonging to the same family, they had never had much in common. Now they did. The conduit was reading. We need to read and to be readers now more than ever. We overschedule our days and complain constantly about being too busy. We shop endlessly for stuff we don't need and then feel oppressed by the clutter that surrounds us. We rarely sleep well or enough. We compare our bodies to the artificial ones we see in magazines and our lives to the exaggerated ones we see on television. We watch cooking shows and then eat fast food. We worry ourselves sick and join gyms we don't visit. We keep up with hundreds of acquaintances but rarely see our best friends. We bombard ourselves with video clips and emails and instant messages. We even interrupt our interruptions. And at the heart of it, for so many, is fear. Fear that we are missing out on something. Wherever we are, someone somewhere is doing or seeing or eating or listening to something better. I'm eager to escape from this way of living. And if enough of us escape, the world will be better for it. Connectivity is one of the great blessings of the internet era, and it makes extraordinary things possible. But constant connectivity can be a curse, encouraging the lesser angels of our nature. None of the nine muses of classical times bore the name impatience or distraction. Books are uniquely suited to helping us change our relationship to the rhythms and habits of daily life in this world of endless connectivity. We can't interrupt books. We can only interrupt ourselves while reading them. They are the expression of an individual or group of individuals, not of a hive mind or collective consciousness. They speak to us thoughtfully, one at a time. They demand our attention. And they demand that we briefly put aside our own beliefs and prejudices and listen to someone else's. You can rant against a book, scribble in the margin, or even chuck it out the window. Still, you won't change the words on the page. The technology of a book is genius. The order of the words is fixed, whether on the page or on the screen, but the speed at which you read them is entirely up to you. Sure, this allows you to skip ahead and jump around, but it also allows you to slow down, savor, and ponder. At the trial in which he would be sentenced to death, Socrates, as quoted by Plato, said that the unexamined life isn't worth living. Reading is the best way I know to learn how to examine your life. By comparing what you've done with what others have done, and your thoughts and theories and feelings with those of others, you learn about yourself and the world around you. Perhaps that is why reading is one of the few things you do alone that can make you feel less alone. It is a solitary activity that connects you to others. So I'm on a search, and have been, I now realize, all my life, to find books to help me make sense of the world, to help me become a better person, to help me get my head around the big questions that I have and answer some of the small ones while I'm at it. I know I'm not alone in my hunger for books to help me find the right questions to ask and find answers to the ones that I have. I am now in my mid-50s, a classic time for introspection. By any age, but any age is a good age for examining your life. Readers from their teens to their 90s have shared with me their desire for a list of books to help guide them. People have always received life-guiding wisdom from certain types of nonfiction, often from self-help books. But all sorts of books can carry this kind of wisdom. A random sentence in a thriller will give me unexpected insight. In fact, novels and works of narrative nonfiction can do something extraordinary that most self-help books can't. They can increase our capacity for empathy by engaging our imagination as they introduce us to a new perspective. I also believe that, to paraphrase the Roman lawyer Pliny the Younger, no book is so bad that you can't find anything in it of interest. You can learn something from the very worst books, even if it is just how crass and base or boring or petty or cruel or intolerant the human race can be. I'm not a particularly disciplined or systematic reader. I'll read anything that catches my eye. Most of the time when I choose what I'm going to read, it has absolutely nothing to do with improving myself. Especially when I'm at my happiest, I'm unlikely to search for a book to make me happier. But it's often during these periods of non-seeking that I've stumbled across a book that has changed my life. Sometimes these books have changed me in relatively trivial ways at first, but then in more significant ways later. When I was 5 years old, my parents read to me E.B. White's 1945 classic, Stuart Little. The story of a remarkable mouse born to a human family. The immediate effect was to make me feel that the thing in life I most desperately wanted was a pet mouse. After much pleading, I was given a gerbil for my birthday. It soon bit me, and I was so upset that I packed my suitcase and ran away from home. I made it 50 yards before I decided to turn back. Now, when I reflect on Stuart Little, I realize this extraordinary tale taught me some powerful lessons. One of them is this. Stuart's human family doesn't care a whit that he is a mouse. It's a tale of radical acceptance. You can be whatever or whoever you are born to be and not risk losing your family. Every child is in some ways different from her or his parents, even if not so different as Stuart is from his. While my parents gave me some of my earliest favorites, teachers guided me to many of the books that would shape my life. In middle school, we read Julius Caesar's The Gallic War. This was the start of my learning a great truth. History is long and I was short. Caesar had accomplished more than I ever could and had written about it in timeless works that would be read as long as people read. There was no chance I would possibly leave a mark on the globe that measured up to Caesar's. Not a bad lesson in humility for a seventh grader. In high school, I read The Odyssey. It taught me a lesson very different from the one my teachers might have expected, yet one that was in a way a corollary to the lesson I'd learned from Caesar, that you should never be ashamed of being mediocre. Of course, The Odyssey is one of the greatest works of all time, but in telling the story of a very flawed hero, it opens up a different lens on greatness. Even Odysseus himself would have had to admit that he didn't do a terrific job getting home. Others managed to come right home after the war chronicled in the Iliad. It took Odysseus a decade, but he does eventually make it. Coming home was essential, and what's important is that he managed to do it. Odysseus was superlative at many things, but getting home wasn't one of them. He was mediocre at that. The beauty of accepting or even embracing mediocrity is that it helps you appreciate excellence. College introduced me to some of the most astonishing books I've ever read, as it should. The experience of reading and studying and revisiting a contemporary masterpiece like Nobel laureate Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon reminds me of how thrilling true greatness is, whether in literature or other aspects of life. I will never forget the images of flight that are present throughout. flight as escape from peril and as a symbol for freedom, flight by foot and through the air. I envy anyone who has yet to read Song of Solomon. Books have also helped me through the worst times in my life, and no book more so than Charles Dickens' David Copperfield. My need to figure out a way to cope with my sadness after finishing this novel was a trial run of sorts for dealing with the deaths of friends. When, as a young teen, I turned the last page, I found myself sobbing because I thought that was the end of my relationship with David Copperfield and with Steerforth and with little Emily and with Dora. But I was wrong. It was just the beginning. I think of them all the time, and I talk to them, too, just as I talk to friends who have died and think about them. Recently, I read a book that is helping me be a better friend. Hanya Yanagihara's devastating novel, A Little Life. The story follows the intertwined lives of four men from right after college until middle age. Along the way, we learn about their childhoods and discover that one of them has been the victim of horrific abuse. I don't think that I've ever read a novel that had so much to say about friendship or about the ways we can and can't help one another, or about the importance of staying present in our friends' lives no matter what. I also turn to books to help remind me of things I know but constantly forget. Wonder by R.J. Palacio is a novel about a boy with a facial deformity who is going to school for the first time. It has a powerful message delivered by the school's principal. He exhorts his students to choose kindness. Quoting J.M. Barrie, he tells them, "Shall we make a new rule of life? Always try to be a little kinder than is necessary." An excellent maxim for fifth graders and the rest of us. Rereading this book and others, I'm reminded that reading isn't just a respite from the relentlessness of technology. It isn't just how I reset and recharge. It isn't just how I escape. It's how I engage, and reading should spur further engagement. Books remain one of the strongest bulwarks we have against tyranny, but only as long as people are free to read all different kinds of books, and only as long as they actually do so. The right to read whatever you want, whenever you want, is one of the fundamental rights that helps preserve all other rights. It's a right we need to guard with unwavering diligence, but it's also a right we can guard with pleasure. Reading isn't just a strike against narrowness, mind control, and domination. It's one of the world's great joys. This was excerpted from Books for Living, published this month by Knopf. And speaking of books, we have the Review of Reviews books. We've got a list of five of the year's best novels and five of the year's best nonfiction works. What I'm going to do for you is read the review of the top of each category and then give you the names and authors of the others in the list. So the year's best novels. Number one, The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. This year's National Book Award winner is something much more interesting than a historical novel, said Juan Gabriel Vasquez in the New York Times. The tale of a teenage slave named Cora who undertakes a long journey toward freedom, it adopts a conceit as simple as it is bold. In the book's fictional world, the Underground Railroad is an actual subterranean network of rails and trains that transports fugitive slaves north, depositing them at random stops along the way. When Cora disembarks in South Carolina, Tennessee, Indiana, and beyond, she encounters half-fantastic worlds that reenact in strikingly skewed ways the crimes America has committed in the name of race. The rabid slave catcher who tails Cora is not her only shadow, said Catherine Schultz in The New Yorker. Cora witnesses lynchings and mass sterilization experiments when she's below the Mason-Dixon line, but the North she slips into offers no true haven. It is slavery as much as a slave catcher that is pursuing her, and anyone alive in today's America knows that she will never entirely outrun it. In the other novels on the list, they have as number two, Swing Time by Zadie Smith. Number three, Home Going by Yaa Gyasi, that's G-Y-A-S-I. Number four, Commonwealth by Ann Patchett. And number five, The Vegetarian by Han Kang, K-A-N-G. And the year's best nonfiction. Number one, Evicted by Matthew Desmond. The struggle to pay rent may sound like a problem the poor have always faced. It's not, said Jason DePaul in the New York Review of Books. Matthew Desmond's spellbinding book pulls readers deep into lives that have been destroyed by the rising costs of even substandard shelter and by landlords who depend on often capricious evictions to turn a profit in the poorest neighborhoods. Desmond, a Harvard sociologist, gathered solid statistics to build his analysis. But it's his ground-level reporting in Milwaukee's rougher districts that lends his message such force. Greedy slumlords and troublesome tenants alike come alive as singular characters, and Evicted builds to become a stirring reminder that the U.S. accepts as ordinary a depth of poverty that is extraordinary and cruel. Desmond, said Carlos Lozada in the Washington Post, has made it impossible to ever again consider poverty in America without tackling the central role of housing. And the other nonfiction books on the list, we have number two, is called Second Hand Time by Svetlana Alexievich, Alexievich. Number three is Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. Number four is titled Shirley Jackson by Ruth Franklin. And number five, When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. That's K-A-L-A-N-I-T-H-I. Here's an interesting summary of some of the poll watch numbers. The way we were in 2016, partisan politics and taxes made us despair, but we found some joy in pizza and TV. How are we feeling? Very conflicted. 64% of Americans are happy with their financial situation, 77% with their career, and 84% with their family and friends. 51% also think the economy is improving, up from 39% a year ago. Yet we're still worried. 74% say the country is headed in the wrong direction. 50% think the nation's best days have passed. And a record 77% say Americans are greatly divided when it comes to the most important values. Whom do we blame for America's problems? The folks in Washington. 82% say that the American that the people running the country don't care about ordinary Americans. 76% have an unfavorable opinion of Congress. 47% of the Supreme Court. President Obama gets better reviews. 55% say he's been a good or great president. But only 21% think Obama's policies helped their personal financial situation, while 33% think they actively hurt their finances. One of the big complaints is the tax code. 67% think the tax system favors the wealthy, and 39% say Uncle Sam takes too much from their paycheck. If it meant they never had to send another penny to the Internal Revenue Service, 27% would get the letters IRS tattooed on their body, while 8% would name their firstborn child taxes. How do we relax? By staring at a screen. 70% regularly engage in marathon TV watching sessions, binging an average of 5 episodes of a show in a single sitting. We also gorge on food. 67% eat for comfort when they're feeling stressed, with 15% saying pizza is their preferred pick-me-up, while 7% scarf ice cream and 5% mac and cheese. 66% say they don't feel guilty after overindulging, but maybe a little regret wouldn't be so bad. A record 28% of American adults are now obese, and another 36% are overweight. How has society changed? We're increasingly open-minded. A record 62% now support same-sex marriage. 72% favor passing laws to protect lesbian, gay, and transgender people from discrimination. And 60% think marijuana should be legalized. But the past year has people concerned we're slipping backwards. 63% believe race relations in the U.S. are in bad shape, the highest number since the 1992 Los Angeles race riots. And 55% think things are only going to get worse. Well, this is awkward timing, but on that note, I'm going to have to end it. Let's all just hope that things actually get better. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.